This is Veronica Goodchild, October 10th, 2014. Synchronicities and their historical background. And this was recorded on DVD. It has quite a few slides. The DVD is available in the library of the Seattle Jung Society.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit and introduce Veronica Goodchild. We're very excited that she's here. Let's see what I've got here. She's been a core faculty member at Pacifica Graduate Institute since 1999 and a Jungian psychotherapist for over 30 years. She's an elected affiliate member of the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts, and she teaches courses in clinical psychology, depth psychology, and depth psychology somatics department on Jungian psychotherapy. Depth psychotherapy and depth psychotherapy, alchemy, imaginal psychology, the Grail myth, psyche and the sacred, and soulful research. She's written numerous articles and a couple of books. She's written a book called Eros and Chaos, The Sacred Mysteries and Dark Shadows of Love, which is an excellent book. And the book that she just published is called Songlines of the Soul, Pathways to a New Vision in a New Century, which is also an amazing book. I'm working my way through it carefully because it's got so much rich information. And to finish off the introduction, I'd just like to read one paragraph from the book, which I think, in my opinion, encapsulates what we may be discovering in this weekend. The intention of this book is neither to disavow the level of three-dimensional space and a fourth time or space-time, nor to discount the importance of psychological work related to our personal life and personal unconscious, especially work on our shadows, which is an ongoing endeavor throughout life, but only to point out that our notion of reality cannot become stuck here. It cannot become stuck here because all the emerging paradigms of reality suggest that there are other dimensions of being intersecting with our own and that these are increasingly making themselves felt. These other domains, these lost worlds, are challenging us to change our attitude, especially in view of the technological power we have amassed, from one of drivenness and control over creation to one of wisdom, cooperation, and love on behalf of creation. These domains are urging us to re-examine our values and recover a sacred sensibility. They seem to reveal, often in quite stark ways and to quite ordinary people, the necessity of not simply going on as usual, but waking up to ourselves in a way that will truly reveal our role as custodians of planet Earth. So, with that, I'd like to welcome Veronica Goodchild.
Thank you. Well, good evening, and thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much to the Society for inviting me here. I'm very happy to be here. I'm going to be talking about a new mythic pattern based on the psychoid archetype, where psyche and matter are one. This brings about, I believe, a seismic change in worldview that comes with this new view of the archetype that Jung elucidated for us. It leads, in my view, to a new myth of matter, which is being picked up by quantum physics, and the psychic realm of subtle bodies. We're learning that spirit has matter, as in the UFO phenomenon, and that matter has spirit, as in the crop circle phenomenon. This all emerges from Jung's later work on synchronicity. And I'd like to read a quote of Jung's. This is from Psychology and Alchemy, volume 12, where he writes, "But the moment when physics touches on the untrodden, untreadable regions, and when psychology has at the same time to admit that there are other forms of psychic life besides the acquisitions of personal consciousness, then the intermediate realm of subtle bodies comes to life again, and the physical and the psychic are once more blended in an indissoluble unity." And he adds, "We have come very near to this turning point today." So I think you can see the where he was going with that as we begin to penetrate the mysteries of subatomic matter, and as psychology, particularly Jungian psychology, goes beyond the personal to the collective archetypal and now psychoid archetype, that this new intermediate realm of subtle bodies is coming into our view and into our experience. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, in chapter 8, Jung says this: "At times I feel as if I'm spread out over the landscape and inside things, and am myself living in every tree, in the splashing of the waves, in the clouds, and the animals that come and go, in the procession of the seasons. Surely a suggestion that our consciousness is not only to be found bound to our physical bodies, but is part of the very spirit of nature herself." This is what synchronicity shows as well, that psyche does not stop at the individual's body boundaries, that the archetype extends into nature. As John Keats put it, "I feel more and more every day as my imagination strengthens that I do not live in this world alone, but in a thousand worlds." I'd like to just give a brief introduction to contextualize my talk a little bit. I've just been reading Anne Bering's, she is a British analyst, Jungian analyst, her latest book, The Dream of the Cosmos, which is an extraordinary book. It's on her website, but please buy the book too. In this monumental volume, An Archetypal and Sociocultural History of Our Planet and Civilization, guided by many of her own dreams, Anne traces how over millennia, a lunar culture of participation in cosmic soul, overseen by the goddess in both her beneficent and terrible aspects, as a symbol of the unity of all life, and gradually as many individual goddesses across cultures, and where a shamanic vision of kinship with animals and nature prevailed, was gradually superseded by a solar patriarchal one. Since about 2500 BC to the present day, almost 4,500 years, the solar era, often equated with the rise of civilization and the rise of the warrior who seeks conquest and the mastery of nature, succeeded in completely eclipsing the participatory experience of the lunar era. With the help of particularly first the church and church fathers, with their edicts and doctrines and institutionalized distortions of the myth of the fall, and then the secular age of science and enlightenment, and the egregious oppression of women through centuries, managed to create a collective image of life that is without spirit, without soul, and without imagination, a kind of anti-life, completely split off from nature and our deeper instincts, and where words like mystery or paranormal, anything that doesn't comport to the prevailing collective, well, I've written delusion, but delusion, are derided and ridiculed. This conditioning has led to the ravages of a world that is breaking down on every conceivable level, economically, educationally, environmentally, and as we know, is completely unsustainable. I have come to realize that my own interest in and experiences with UFOs and crop circles archetypally as symbols of the self approaching us both from afar, from the spiritual realms, and also right beneath our feet in mandala images in fields of grain, that is in nature, matter, from our earth, are, like some dreams, exaggerated attempts, compensatory messages, we say, to draw our attention to the absolute necessity in our times to return to a sacred attitude toward life and the cosmos, where the matter of soul and the spirit of nature can once again be embraced. not in a regressive participation, but with consciousness, with the insights of depth and especially Jungian psychology, and of course the new sciences, and especially in a spirit of love. This is where I think Jung was heading with his synchronicity and UFO studies. That is a completely new vision of being in the world and part of the wider arc of nature and creation. A new cosmology informed by the expansion of our knowledge about the universe out there and the mysteries of the subatomic world down here, and of course, the deep mystery of our own natures. According to science, we know only 4% of the cosmos. The rest, 96%, is made of dark matter and dark energy, about which we know virtually nothing. And that's just the physical universe. We are living on the edge of momentous evolutionary change. Anne speaks of this as an emerging alchemical stellar consciousness. I love this statistic because it makes me feel that there's room for new vision and an evolution of consciousness and matter. And I also like to speak of Jung's primarily interpretive symbolic consciousness, his logos self, searching for an eros self and an eros ego. The eros self often feels a bit foolish, as it depends on introverted states and direct experiences of feeling and sensing. And sometimes these can sound a bit strange when put into extroverted expression, which is what I will be doing in this lecture. So, having given that kind of context for my talk, what I'd like to do is just play a couple of minutes. I want to show you to music just some images of crop circles. And I would ask you to allow yourself to let go of whoever you were when you walked in the room and just to sink into being here now, being present, and trying to adopt a kind of beginner's mind if you can. And I'll try and do the same thing. Thank you. Maybe a bit hard to see with the lights, but hopefully you'll be able to see well enough. Here's an image of a crop circle from 2012, July the 20th. This particular one, this is stage three, phase three of it. It actually came down in the church-looking building. Formation came first, and then the circular one above. It was absolutely massive, this one. I'll say more about it in a bit. This is probably really familiar to you. It's a woodcut that's in Jung's UFO essay, plate number 7. It's called The Spiritual Pilgrim, Discovering Another World. To me, this suggests the kind of area that I'm interested in exploring. You see how the pilgrim is kneeling on the earth and is in ordinary reality. There's Seattle in the background. Sun, stars, moon, the tree, maybe the tree of life in the middle. But the pilgrim is, as it were, poking her head through what the alchemists call the fenestra eternitatis, the window onto eternity. And there you can see that beyond the ordinary space-time dimension, there's a slightly stranger-looking world. Von Franz says that the image, the symbol up at the top, symbolizes the double wheels of Ezekiel. And for her, that symbol had to do with the connection of eternal time and finite time, which in synchronicities, those two wheels of time, if you like, lock momentarily. This is also from Flying Saucers. This is a painting by a woman called Irene Champernowne. She was a patient of Tony Wolfe. She lived in England. She ran a residential facility for people with psychological problems using Jung's work. And this painting, as you can see, there are two figures at the edge of the earth, and they're witnessing this UFO approaching. See maybe the moon up there in the top left. And she was quite remarkable because she was dreaming about UFOs in the mid-30s, 40s and 50s. And Jung and Emma Jung and Tony Wolfe were very interested in her paintings and her dreams. She also had this incredible dream, this is Irene, of a great black, ugly, almost obscene woman who fell from heaven into the sea. And then, as she writes, of waving corn beneath the water, that she knew, anticipated the future and a new vision of reality, which she didn't yet understand. And this is what Jung and Emma and Tony all felt about her visions and her dreams, that they were anticipating a new vision of reality. With UFOs, we see perhaps that spirit has matter with the, as I've already said, with the crop circles. We see that matter perhaps has spirit, and we're being invited back into that way of looking at things. So I'm going to be talking, as I said, a little bit about my book. And my book really concerns this new idea of a psychophysical reality, which I think points to a new mythic pattern and its signatures, beginning with synchronicities and then moving on to collective synchronicities. As Jung said, UFOs are collective synchronicities because they're both had to do with the perhaps the projection of an archetypal content, But they weren't only that, because they could be traced on radar, so they had a physical presence. So they were both, like synchronicities are. So synchronicities, individual ones, collective ones, such as UFOs and crop circles, and I also actually believe, although I won't be going into it, that all the research that's being done on near-death studies also goes into this psychoidal realm. And there probably are other examples too, like the Marian visions, perhaps. And this new story, this new worldview, is one that values matter as well as spirit equally, passion as well as vision equally, feeling as well as thinking equally. And here we surrender to that point where matter and spirit touch and do not touch, where passion and vision touch and do not touch, where feeling and thinking touch and do not touch. A zero point, intermediate and intermediating realm with its figures, landscapes, and mysteries. A subtle in-between world accessed, as the mystics have told us since time immemorial, by the creative imagination and the knowledge of unity, which we once knew but have forgotten, comes into prominence again. So first I'd like to mention why my book has the word songlines in it, which came to me. I didn't think it up. It was just had to be in the title. And as you probably know, it comes from the Aboriginal musical notes or dreaming tracks, considered to be a kind of map or direction finder to those who shared one's dreaming. And also, though, it comes from the Greek oime, which means a song, but also a pathway to another world. And so my book, in part, is about ways in which these song lines, or what I also call the other world, to distinguish this from the underworld of depth psychology, is opening up today. And these ideas were also seeded by dreams, my own dreams. One dream I had as a child that stayed with me when I was about 5 or 6. I had an experience of light in the garden where I grew up. And I knew as a 6-year-old that I came from that light, and I knew that one day I would return to it. And I think that dream, as a child, opened me to the reality of this, what I'm now calling another world. I also had a dream that was the more immediate impetus to my book, which I've written about in my book, so I won't go into that now. And right before I sent my manuscript out, I wanted a sign from the other side that I was doing the right thing. And so I asked the dream time, I said, please, can you give me a message that it's okay to be sending this manuscript out? And I had a dream of Jung, and it was a very powerful dream, and I haven't dreamt about Jung in decades. And in the dream, I've also written about this in my book, he takes me out of a church, and he makes me look up at the sky, and as we do that, the clouds disperse, and when we see a new star, he says, and he implies, this is a new star. And at the same time, he points down to the earth, and we're looking at the earth, and I know that he's saying to me that this church, which was a church connected with Mary Magdalene, he was pointing to the pathways, and he was indicating that sacred churches and sites are connected by what the Chinese call the dragon paths. And so I knew he was talking about the subtle body of the earth too. And so the idea was that the star and the dragon lines were connected. And I go into some of the symbolism of that dream. So I felt very assured that it was okay. So I mention these things because I know that my own experience is only a reflection, an example of a much larger story that many are experiencing today. And this story involves a renewal of a level of consciousness that was put aside when alchemy split into the rise of science, on the one hand, in the 17th century, and the magical or mystical side of the subtle in-between world, which the alchemists called lapis gold, or the creation of the diamond body, which of course were completely heretical notions to the Orthodox Christian Church. descended into the unconscious on the other. It is the intersection of quantum physics and the psychology of the unconscious, particularly as this issue is expressed in the relationship of Pauli and Jung, that can educate and help us, help give us insight into the so-called psychophysical problem and its underlying conjunctio archetype that is constellated today. That is the union of psyche, matter, mysteries, and which involve this third intermediate subtle realm, which Jung calls that zero point. That neither Newtonian science nor superficial psychology can either admit or can explain. There's a very good book called The Return of the World Soul, written by a prior physicist who's a Jungian analyst in Zurich, and I highly recommend it to you because he is also working on this psychophysical problem that he said Jung and Pauli did not solve. It's a very interesting book. It's in two volumes. Remo Roth, Remo F. Roth. He worked with von Franz for about 25 or 30 years. So the context for this idea of renewal is that we live at a time of both suffering and strife, but also a time of great possibility and change. You know, this archetypal pattern of destruction and renewal is that alchemical sort of nigredo, the dark night of the soul, which I think we're all living through right now. Jung wrote about this in his volume, Civilization in Transition, where he said, a mood of universal destruction and renewal has set its mark on our age. This mood makes itself felt everywhere, politically, socially, philosophically. We are living, he says, in what the Greeks called the kairos, the right moment for a metamorphosis of the gods, of the fundamental principles and symbols. So I think we don't have to look too far to see the collapse of culture and the environment worldwide. But where there's death, there is renewal. So what might be some of the new pathways, some of the dreaming tracks, the song lines, opening up in our understanding of reality at this time of momentous change? This is what I've tried to engage in my book. So it's in four parts. Part one is Introduction to the Subtle Body and Subtle Worlds. And my chapters in this part are grounded in Jung, which I think is the next slide. Particularly his differentiation of the archetype to include its psychoid dimension, and this is what he talked about after all his studies on synchronicity, that psyche has matter, and matter has psyche. That completely changed his view of the archetype. The world is not the same after that further differentiation of the archetype, but I don't think we've caught up with that. We maybe get to synchronicity and then we stop. We just stop thinking for some reason and maybe don't even get to synchronicity. But all the ideas are there in his writings. And so it's this idea that the psyche can't only be within, because when you experience a synchronicity, there's a non-local event in the world. So his idea was that it was the archetype that united the two, and therefore the archetype can't only be psychological. It must extend into matter. So also individuation, he writes about individuation as an initiatory alchemical process toward the creation of the subtle body. That's in some of Jung's writings, when he's not talking endlessly about projection. Projection works some of the time, I would say, and I think we have to really take it into account, especially when we're working on our shadows. but there's another view of the archetype, which is much more participatory. And that's what I'm interested in as well. So we've also looked quite a lot at Henri Corbin's work, because he talks a lot about subtle worlds, mundus imaginalis, and the co-creative power of the spiritual imagination from Sufi Gnosticism, and the notion of the subtle body in East and Western traditions. And I also in this part, I view many of Jung's own experiences as journeys to the imaginal world. The Red Book, of course, is a key example. But so too is the account of his near-death experience. As he says, there was nothing subjective about it. It was completely objective. And he also discussed some remarkable visions. There was the Ravenna vision, which is where he and Tony Wolfe, I think it was, saw frescoes that actually weren't there, but they had been there in history. It's a marvelous story. It's in MDR, but I also discussed that. And he also had what he called an alchemical vision of Christ, which actually brought this idea of spirit and matter together, because the alchemical Christ was a green gold, and I go into that too. And part of the quality of these sorts of experiences is that they are really real, and so we can't only look at them through the lens of symbolic thinking. Symbolic thinking is, of course, what Jung gave to us, but it misses the eros of the direct experience, and I think that part can't be left out. And also it says everything's psychological, because if everything's just symbolic, then it suggests that the event isn't real. And we know from crop circle stories, and we know from UFO and ET stories, that there is something happening that's not just subjective. It's not just a projection. It's another reality. And I also include many contemporary examples, my own, my students and patients. And so there's a lot of... I wanted to give lots of examples in the book because I thought this would really bring it alive and would really make it more readable apart from anything else. So I have some very good examples of what I'm calling this access to the mundus imaginalis, or the imaginal world that we get through the eye of the heart, which is really the creative imagination that resides in the heart, and hence the connection to Eros. And all these stories, Jung's and other ones that I tell in the book, are stories that point to the seamless web of soul, nature, culture, and cosmos, found, of course, in indigenous cultures across the globe. They haven't lost that sense of connection. Okay, in part two, I go into synchronicity in some detail. Because to me, Jung's synchronicity studies is where his psychology really changes. So in a way, you could say that synchronicity is a kind of updating of alchemy, because it's about matter and psyche, and that's what the alchemists were interested in. They're a kind of dreaming while awake. And one of the things, of course, that are really important about synchronicities is that they restore our lost connection to nature. So, you know, in the early 50s, Jung, who throughout his life had had experiences of synchronicity with patients, colleagues, friends, and had had many discussions about it, finally published his monograph. And he was very encouraged to do this by his relationship with Wolfgang Pauli, the physicist. Of course, synchronicity by its very nature completely upsets the Western scientific view and, as Jung says, prejudice of reality. It's always good to be aware of our prejudices. By pointing to events that are determined not by cause, but by definition, a causality is what happens here. And where Jung says cause has to be inconceivable, because many so-called synchronistic events are really not that. And that's why a careful understanding of what Jung says about synchronicity, to my mind, is quite important. So there's Pauli. That's Pauli there. He came to the States, of course, but he went back. He couldn't stand what the American government was doing with his research, because it was all going into defense. So he went back to Switzerland. There's the synchronicity book. So they both worked on this together. Now, you probably know Jung's scarab. Do you know Jung's scarab example? The dream of his patient? So he had a referral, and she'd gone through a few therapists. She hadn't kind of lasted in therapy. I think we've all had patients like that. And so when she was referred to Jung, he thought the same thing would probably happen. He said that she was so caught up in her Cartesian rational mind that she wasn't open to change. So she finally had a dream, and in the dream she was handed a golden scarab. And the dream impacted her enough that she remembered to tell Jung when she went for her therapy session. So she went to her therapy session. She told Jung the dream, very numinous dream, of being handed this golden scarab. And at that moment of telling the dream, there was this tapping at the window, and not a golden scarab, but the closest thing to it, a rose chafer beetle was at the window. Jung opened the window and said, "Here is your scarab beetle." And so it was really important because it knocked her over, knocked her sideways, and that was really important. We can't change if we're not knocked sideways off our rational mind, out of our rational minds. So the dream, of course, gave her an actual direct experience of something very numinous and transpersonal. And then Jung, you know, being a fairly decent therapist, I guess, helped her see that the scarab beetle in Egyptian mythology is the symbol of death and rebirth. So he said that after that she could follow her individuation process because she could fall into a more irrational place. So synchronicity honors the unique and rare, not the repeatable, controllable, and predictable, which is all about Western scientific method. Because such events occur slightly outside of, well, they occur, they're not causally related, so time and space become relative, not fixed. And this leads to that temporary altered state of consciousness, an aha moment that often is experienced as deeply meaningful, like the patient with her dream and the scarab, the beetle coming through the window. This transformative moment happens in what Jung calls the kairos, which is this sense of divine timing or the right moment that brings us into the present, into the now. We are brought stunningly into the present moment. The numinosity or the sense of mystery or sacredness of this moment suggests an archetypal foundation to such constellated events, which is why, as Jung says, synchronicities tend to occur at typical moments. Death, initiation, intense love. Or today, as the new myth and its archetypal patterns are breaking through in a kind of cultural initiation. This slightly altered consciousness links with this breakthrough of what Jung calls, again from alchemy, the unus mundus world, the one world. Jung called the unus mundus the psychophysical reality. And it was thought to be an originating point of both psyche and matter. And therefore they came to the conclusion that psyche and matter are therefore complementary realms of one underlying reality. The direct experience of this energy from the archetypal world I call Eros consciousness. And it balances symbolic thinking with a more feeling response. I also link it to the presence of Sophia, a personification of the wisdom sensibility that unfolds, hopefully, with a maturing of the personality during individuation. And also Jung says that with synchronicities, fate seems to play a part because something happens which is beyond the ego's will or intent. It's really interesting to think of the fateful things that have happened in your life that often completely shift our lives. Beyond the ego, though, it's good. So he goes further, and he writes in the essay on synchronicity that they are irrational and impossible. And that, so think UFOs and crop circles. Think of anything that you maybe judge is totally irrational and completely impossible. And he says the irrational and the impossible is absolutely essential for our wholeness. Furthermore, because their meaning depends on our observation and our recognition of how we're being affected, moved, touched, Our consciousness itself becomes a co-creating factor in a new understanding of reality. This is really important for Jung too, about that's the cosmological meaning of consciousness, he says, that we actually help co-create the world through our engagement with it. And moreover, he says that at these times, we often think things that we don't really know. And we don't know consciously, but they come to us in those moments as if we just know something. And he calls that foreknowledge or absolute knowledge, which really means that you get knowledge directly from the source. It bypasses the ego and goes right down to the source, and then it'll come up. And so he calls synchronicities, because of their spontaneity, acts of creation in time. They're new creations out of the world soul. And he calls this creatio continua, continuing creation, versus creation ex nihilo, which was the idea that there's a big bang and then everything goes from there and, nothing new basically happens. So synchronicities point to the possibility of new creations happening all the time. And he and von Franz talked about how in such events we're being asked to create something new, and therefore it's not just having the synchronicity that's important, it's what you do with it. And so it's about stabilizing the energy. How are you being called through this synchronicity to a new conception of reality, a new creative work, a new attitude, which you then have to embody and live? And that's what taking the psyche seriously is about, how you live what you know. And so, of course, he had his war visions, which are also reported in the Red Book, his own synchronicities, many of them, of course. I want to say something a little bit about the historical background of Jung's idea on synchronicity, but then I'm going to move forward because I'm not going to have enough time. But just to say that there is a very interesting background. Here's the alchemical Sophia with the alchemist following in her footsteps. The title of this drawing is Let Nature Be Thy Guide. So there was this historical background in the West to synchronicity, especially with the Hermetic alchemists who were actually physicians like Paracelsus. Jung writes a lot about Paracelsus in Alchemical Studies. And these alchemists recognized an intermediate world where spirit and matter met and were considered of equal value. And as we've seen, Jung talks about this when he's not talking about alchemy as a projection of matter, you know, the unconscious onto matter. He talks about this as the world of subtle bodies. And so this world was personified in the Middle Ages by Sophia, sometimes called Sapientiae Dei, the wisdom of God, or sometimes called Mary. And they were considered the creative arm of God, also called the anima mundi, or soul of the world. And these feminine forms were an expression of God manifesting himself in the world. And the anima mundi was considered an active feminine energetic principle, a place where magic, or what we would now call the paranormal and the parapsychological, took place. These things were valued. And they were considered spontaneous new creations out of the world soul, based on the kairos and acausality, creations co-created by our observations. And again, linked with eros. And Sophia, or the Sapientiae Dei, was also connected with something called the Lumen Naturae, the light of nature, or the spirit of matter. And Paracelsus wrote quite a lot on the Lumen Naturae. He said it emanated from the stars and was associated with the astral body, an invisible, subtle body that was born with individuals and that survived physical death. You see, these are old ideas which are now gradually returning to us. In near-death studies is pretty much when these people have these near-death studies, they're absolutely convinced that they come back with absolutely no fear of death after that. They just know that they're going to transition into another dimension. It's quite extraordinary, the literature on that. And there are two quite good books, recent ones. One's called Dying to Be Me by a woman called Anita Moorjani. And the other is by a very materialistic scientist, a neurosurgeon. What's his name? Proof of Heaven, it's called. But he said, if you'd ever wanted someone who didn't believe in the soul or God or anything, or just believe that we're just, you know, consciousness is a byproduct of the brain, etc., he said, I'm your man, you know. I total materialistic, reductive scientist. And it totally changed his life, his near-death experience. He wrote a book. Now he helps people understand that he's absolutely convinced that he was completely wrong. So these things are very interesting. But these are old ideas, and we lost them because since the 17th century, we've lost the soul, we've lost the spirit, we've lost the idea of life after death. We live in an incredibly impoverished culture, collectively. So he thought, Paracelsus thought that animals were attuned to the luminatori. And so the auguries of birds, for example, could be linked to premonitions guided by the spirits of the luminatori. And so it was this incredible idea that there was wisdom held in the natural world beyond the ideas of traditional thought, and that an instinctual, intuitive, imaginal way of knowing based on one's own experience really had to be honored. Paracelsus thought that this light of nature was active during sleep and was revealed in dreams or visions. And he also described it as a kind of illumination that dwells in the heart. And, you know, there were other alchemists, one particularly, Ficino, who regarded the whole universe from stars to states of mind as a living being, united by correspondences, and that the cosmos was a body linked with the world soul and the divine nous. See, the ideas of Earth coming back as Gaia, as a living being, is also returning to us now, thank God. Because once you experience the Earth as a living, breathing being, you can't mindlessly go on just raping her for her resources. It changes your attitude. And the environmental movement, of course, is all about that. So here's a picture of the Anima Mundi. You see how she stretches from the deepest mysteries down to the most elemental realms. It's beautiful. So all of nature and the cosmos is alive and animated by soul. And, of course, the spiritual imagination or the visionary imagination that resides in the heart is how we attune ourselves. Corban talks about an attunement to the Mundus Imaginalis, because he says you can't describe it rationally. It's very subtle, but you can practice connecting with it. And that through this kind of attunement, that the practitioner goes through transformations. And Ficino thought that such transformations often manifest as a spiritual experience that resituates the individual soul in the context of nature and the cosmos and extends into cosmological speculations. Well, that's in a way where we are now with the ET myth that we see in all these movies, with the crop circles. We're being invited, I think, and, you know, often movies carry the myths for a culture, for our culture they do. Some of these old ideas are coming back to us in new ways now, I think. Thank God. I mean, look at all the NASA photographs of the cosmos. I mean, if that just doesn't break you open, I don't know what else could. There's such beauty out there. Such beauty. And, of course, there are images from Jung's Red Book that also show these features. Here's Philemon. Big serpent down there, his teacher that he said he went walking up and down the garden with. See, that serpent in a way connected to the deep earth, but it's also rising up. It's like a tree of life coming out of it. And then this one could have been from Ficino. See, it goes from the most instinctual to the most holy. It's all held together. Beautiful. A kind of world tree. I think he calls it the world tree. So Jung's synchronicity hypothesis then shows empirical evidence for these historical metaphysical ideas. While the mandala, which could be Ficino's whole universe united by correspondences, or the circular horoscope, for example, is the psychological equivalent of the Unus Mundus, synchronicities demonstrate the parapsychological equivalent of the Unus Mundus. As we have seen in describing the synchronicity principle, Jung speaks of the interconnectedness of all being. That's what it brings back for us. The recovery of the idea that nature is alive and has soul, the co-creative power of consciousness and imagination, access to unusual knowledge, and the aha or numinous moment that makes life change and often helps open the heart. His extension of this principle to collective expressions of it also takes us beyond to a broader conception and experience of the earth and the cosmos. Did you see the Cosmos series with, can't remember his name, well, yeah. I think cosmology studies are the ones that are really helping bring back spirituality, actually. Tyson, yeah. So, a little bit about UFOs. This is a picture of the so-called Phoenix Lights, March the 13th, 1997, which was a massive display of UFOs seen by most of the people in Phoenix. There's a movie you can see on YouTube, actually, as well, if you want. Very interesting. I don't know if any of you have actually read Jung's UFO monograph, published in 1959, 2 years before his death. He was really interested in UFOs, and he was researching all the available material. He associated their appearance with the move from the age of Pisces to the age of Aquarius, as he says in the opening paragraphs, because he felt, as we've already noted, that our time was marked by profound change. But as I said, he said if UFOs were a rumor, then they'd point to an archetypal event, but if they were also physically real, they would point to a synchronicity, a collective synchronicity, because of their universal appearance. His subtitle of the essay is that UFOs were a new myth of things seen in the skies. And he basically approaches his topic from an archetypal point of view. In the end, and this is, I'm afraid, where Jung disappoints me, we like saying dreams are really important, but we don't want to look at individual dreams. He talks about their incomprehensible reality, and he acknowledges that they behave mercurially, that is, not according to known laws. And, he talked quite a bit, and in his letters, his correspondence, quite a lot about the relativity of the space-time dimension due to telepathic and precognition events. And so somewhere, it's in Collected Works 8, he does this quote, I really like this. A limitation of consciousness in space and time is such an overwhelming reality that every occasion when this fundamental truth is broken through must rank as an event of the highest theoretical significance. For it would prove that the space-time barrier can be annulled. The annulling factor would then be the objective psyche, since space-time would attach to it at most as a relative and conditioned quality. Under certain conditions, it could even break through the barriers of space and time precisely because of a quality essential to it. That is, its relatively transspatial and transtemporal nature. So I think what he's saying here is that psyche can reach into a sphere beyond space-time, and that psyche can annul space-time because it itself possesses a trans-space and time quality. Something to think about when we look at anomalous experiences, I think. And he also thought that we ought to question the idea that the psyche is attached to the brain. All you neuroscientist types out there. So there's lots more that could be said about that. But he basically identifies five archetypes because Jung, as you know, I think he would have had the same approach to crop circles. He wasn't so interested in where they came from, but Jung's thing was, what do they mean? So if you're being a good Jungian, you don't worry about where crop circles come from, and you don't get attached to, oh, they're from ETs or they're from, you know, the government or something, or Bill and Bob or whatever it was, those two guys that were making them all. Because that's the old kind of divisive thinking. What he was interested in was, what do they mean? And so this is Jung's myth of meaning is really about symbolic thinking. And so looking at dreams and paintings of UFOs, he speaks of the basically five archetypes: the visionary rumor, the archetype of initiation, the shadow and liminal aspect of the trickster, the theme of apocalypse, which means unveiling, which is often associated with the end of world fantasies, but doesn't mean that, it means unveiling, and the new eon, Pisces to Aquarius. For Jung, UFOs are mandala images of the self. And if you look at most of those crop circles, they all have that mandala pattern, at least many of them do. They don't all, like, not all UFOs are circular, but you can see that they have that mandala structure, a lot of them. So it's the self appearing in matter from a Jungian point of view is my take on that. And he said that, you know, that these UFOs had to do with the fact that we were at a time of terrible disorientation and collapse, and that they appeared as a kind of, you know, image of wholeness due to the mass-mindedness and spiritual bankruptcy characteristic of our times, and that they have cosmic significance as attempts when religions no longer serve for many people, to help us feel that we're connected to something beyond ourselves. But what about their reality? And I do go into a lot of examples about the reality of people's experiences because I think it's so important. And the main people there are Dr. John Mack from Harvard University, who wrote Passport to the Cosmos. That's one of the really good books. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. He died prematurely, car accident in London. But we have him, and then we also have a new book by a Jungian analyst, Dr. Bernice Hill, who's written a book called The Emergence of the Cosmic Psyche. So we have Jungian friends out there who are interested in this stuff. It's really nice. It's very encouraging. So I want to make sure I don't go too much over my time. So I'm going to just say a few things about the experiences because they're more intense. They tend to be more intense than individual synchronicities. There is a move into presence, a kind of psychocosmic landscape. We know that experiencers, as Mac calls people who've had ET or UFO encounters, they often meet guides of the soul, angelic forces. They're often exposed to images of our suffering earth or landscapes of destruction, and they're often told this is what's happening to your earth and you really need to get on board to be doing something to help the earth. And by the way, if you don't read anything else on Jung's essay on UFOs, in the epilogue, he has a marvelous story about an individual encounter by a man called Orfeo Angelucci. It sounds like someone from Saturday Night Live, but it's not actually. It's a guy from the 50s who had extraordinary experiences with, and I would urge you to read it. It's really interesting. And Jung talks about how important the name is, Orfeo and Angelucci. Talks about the if his name really was that, then we really have to pay attention to what was going on there. And I do talk about that in my book as well. So UFO encounters are often described as really happening, not a dream. They tend to be both intensely physical and psychical. They have a subtle body nature. Beyond just a sense of meaning, the participant describes often illuminative experiences concerning the nature of the world and reality itself, often telepathically communicated by the guides, and often gain insight into issues of planetary, global, and even galactic significance. Very interesting. Often through, if people have repeated experience, sometimes they're initially traumatic. Often they change over time, a bit like alchemy, you know, the Negredo. You can go through the tormenting stage of your depression and so on. But as time unfolds and things stabilize, you have more beneficent kinds of experiences. They've been compared with kundalini openings, where encounter people often describe that they're addressed by concerns way beyond their own personal interests and are often led to change their life's work to a vocational destiny as a planetary citizen unimaginable before. It's really extraordinary how these people are, like in near-death experiences, transformed quickly. It's like time is running out. We don't have years of endless, you know, individuation that maybe some of us did 10, 20 years or whatever. There isn't really time for that anymore, I don't think. Or if there is time, we need also to be paying attention to our Earth. In my book, I won't go into that now, but I go into the mystical, angelic, shamanic, and indigenous background to such experiences. And Dr. Hill gives some really amazing accounts in her book, ones I'd never heard of before, and just some lovely things. She talks about a shaman from South Africa called Credo Mutvar. Some of you probably have heard of him. He has spoken openly about his ET contacts and how they describe Earth as a mother planet. Though there are many planets, mother planets are rare, and their purpose is to give birth to life. Dr. Hill writes, Earth was known throughout the galaxy as a place of rare beauty. Filled with old-growth forests, snow-capped mountains, gorgeous waterfalls, rich vegetation, and oceans teeming with fish. Now seen from space, much of this life is dying. We know that species extinction is accelerating at a much faster pace than had been anticipated. And even in the New York Times from a couple of Sundays ago, you probably saw it, there was articles on this, and efforts are being made to preserve vulnerable species. One really nice story of her own, she recounts, this is Dr. Hill, Bernice Hill, in her book, a dream vision in which she's given a direct experience of what she calls cosmic kindness by some ETs, a compassion beyond anything she'd experienced before. She writes that there is a relationship between our ET visitors and the emerging depth of our being. Some ETs know the cosmos deeply, she says, and they both share that knowledge and or stimulate our desire to find it within ourselves. She adds that in Flying Saucers, Jung, in looking beyond the personal equation in dreams to their collective significance, writes that we need a fundamental change in attitude, a real recognition of what it means to be a whole human being. And for Hill, the felt energy of kindness is part of this attitude, a new sense of wholeness. She writes that it points to the constellation of a new vibration of energy, a new frequency coming into our world. Let us hope that's true. Of course, the shadow aspects of these creative advances can be seen in technology run amok and the creation and release of the atom bomb, collective possessions, whose psyche matter violation has become destructive. It comes out of the will. If new archetypal patterns are constellating, as Jung suggests, then we are all under their influence. This does not mean, however, that we understand what is happening. And Jung urges us to reflect and to try to understand the metamorphosis underway. So now I'd like to move to just some things on crop circles. I have a whole chapter in my book on crop circles. I'm sure Jung would have been interested in them, as I said. But he died in 1961, and crop circles most recently have only been appearing since 1980, the last 30 years. He was always interested in the odd, the heretical. And as he says in a letter in 1957 to the head of a foreign bookstore in Paris, with who was asking him what he was studying, he said that he was always interested in what is off the beaten track and is usually ridiculed or simply shrugged off with a joke. We might think about all those things that we ridicule and shrug off with a joke and wonder what we might be missing. He adds that his UFO interests were another expression of his attention to all archetypal forms in life: biology, physics, art, myth, parapsychology, as well as dreams. Adding, the intimation of forms hovering in the background, not in itself knowable, gives life the depth, which it seems to me makes it worth living. I think he might have felt the same about crop circles. I certainly do. So if UFOs are a myth of things seen in the skies, we can add now that crop circles are a myth of things seen on the earth. And then we have this new alchemical union of above and below. So to me, it completes that alchemical union. With what the alchemists call the holy wedding, the marriage of masculine and feminine. So again, these crop circle mysteries are spontaneous products, I think, of the world soul, wherever they come from, because they also appear spontaneously and unpredictably overnight, or in the very early hours of the morning, quite quickly, within seconds, actually. If you go to temporarytemples.co.uk, you can see they have a massive library of crop circle images from over the years. I think they only started in 2001, though. There are some authenticated video clips of formations forming. And in the ones that I've seen, there are these lights that go circle around a field, very small white lights, kind of circle like this around a field, and then within seconds, the pattern goes down. It takes about 3 or 4 seconds. It's absolutely magical. They take place every spring and summer in England. The ones that you saw were from England, mostly but not exclusively in Britain's sacred landscape of the Avebury, Stonehenge, Glastonbury Triangle. By the way, I don't know whether you saw, they've just discovered that Stonehenge is much more massive than they thought it was, and from, I don't know, rain or something, or overhead photography, they realize that Stonehenge is actually a massive complex, which is very exciting. But these formations, they don't only appear in England. They appear in Europe, Canada, Mexico, the USA. In the USA, the ones I know about are Serpent Mound in Ohio is one. It's in land that's sacred to native peoples. And as I say, they've been appearing most recently for about 30 years. There's also good archival evidence that they appeared at earlier times in history. So they've been studied from many points of view. Scientific protocols have been developed to distinguish the hoaxes from the genuine phenomena, because some are human-made. The key thing for me about them, maybe you had a sense of that when you were watching the slides, is their geometric structure, their absolute beauty. I mean, to me, they're just so beautiful. Plato, as you might remember, speaks of beauty as awakening the soul to what it once knew but has forgotten in the lands beyond time. And perhaps most importantly, they point us to the mystery of matter itself, of our earth, and its call to us to live within its mystery rather than off its resources. It is perhaps a call to the indigenous self within each of us, a return to the recognition that we're merely one expression of nature, and we need to learn to live in relationship with the other inhabitants of our home, plants, trees, flowers, stones, animals, sea creatures, mountains. Perhaps we're called to remember the Buddha nature in all things, and to recall the ancient idea of the lumen naturae, the light of nature from alchemy. In my chapter, I also include some psychological reflections on the sacred feminine, particularly in terms of beauty, the myth of Aphrodite I write about, and in terms of the phenomena taking place in wheat, the myth of Demeter, the corn goddess, and Persephone, the corn maiden, and how these myths might be speaking to us today. With crop circles, we return to earth, but earth as celestial earth, as Corbin would say, another earth, as it were, strewn with stars. I just have one or two examples of some, and I've talked a bit about their imagery, which I think will take me too long. This is one from 2012. It was the last time we were in England, going into some of these formations. It's a kind of bird serpent or plumed serpent theme, which see, it's kind of a serpent head, but it's got all these 13 of them, I think. So, of course, the serpent image is probably one of the most important symbols in Jungian psychology, right? it speaks to something primordial and far from human consciousness, yet somehow enduring. The wellspring of all manifestation, the serpent points to the subtle energy of life, libido, sexuality, or the dragon paths, the ley lines on earth that connect sacred sites with the stars, the dragon that protects the treasure. So here in this formation, one could say the spine is emphasized, perhaps alluding to the kundalini awakening of energy up the spine to enliven all the chakras, an energy that connects to both internal organs and outwards to universal energy in its manifestations. Of course, the serpent was always associated with the ancient goddess, with the goddess and with transformation, because the serpent sheds its skin and so points to death and renewal, perhaps mirroring the times that we're in. The serpent is also related to Apollo and Dionysus, the two great gods of poetry, music, healing and divination. The loosening of two rigid boundaries to reach a deeper mantic wisdom. Surely this might relate to what we're being invited to in our times. This one actually occurred over two nights too. It was filled in. But this is a key in alchemy, this symbol. It's the Seal of Solomon or the Star of David. It's two interlocking triangles, one pointing up, the other pointing down. So it's a union of opposites. A double triadic mandala centers one in the heart. That's the point in the middle. This is my favorite crop circle from 2001. It appeared overnight in a very remote area after a very, very rainy storm. It's about the size of two football fields or something. You can see people. You can see how massive they are, because when you see people in them, you can... It's absolutely huge. There are 410 circles in that. No sign of any boots or anything. Muddy boots. Just extraordinary. Just extraordinary. I wanted to say a little bit about being in the crop circles, because that's another whole perspective. sometimes you can feel just extraordinary energy. That first crop circle I showed you at the beginning, I was walking into the field. I couldn't see the. You can't see the formation from the road very often. But I met some people who'd been in the day before and were going back, and I asked if I could follow them in because they knew where it was. And when I stepped over the boundary from outside to inside the circle, I got met with an absolute wave of unbelievably loving energy. It actually brought me to tears right away. At one moment I was outside the formation talking to these people in an ordinary, ordinary blah, blah. And then the next thing I stopped over and I was absolutely transfixed. And the voice said in my head, "This is from Sirius." What to say about that, I don't know. But it was filled with unconditional love. That's the only thing I can say. And so I spent about 2 hours in it, and I went down to the bottom. There was a new bit that I didn't know had just been added on. And I lay down on the grass, and I just lay there for about 2 hours. I was just overcome with utter gratitude. This one is rather extraordinary. It's from the same year. Of course, you're seeing it from a particular vantage point. You can see it from any vantage point. But this also seemed very Pleiadian to me, if that means anything to anybody. Again, it was just... We were lucky to be in that very... Came down that same morning we were in it. We were very lucky. Very bouncy. Just beautiful, benign energy. So loving, just so loving. You know, they don't hurt anybody. They just come down. There they are. Lots of people come from all over the world, do ceremony in them. Actually, Credo Matva says in Africa when they come down, they don't go into the circle formations because they're considered so sacred, so holy. They're considered gifts from the star gods, and they don't actually go in the formations. I wanted to say something very briefly about crop circle dreams, because I got quite interested in dreams with crop circles in them. So I'll just say this very quickly, because I think we're running out of time. But just to say something about crop circle dreams, I think I did give one or two examples in my text. But this was quite interesting. I had a dream. I was giving a talk at the Devizes Crop Circle Conference in 2012. They wanted a Jungian approach on crop circles. So I went to give a talk. But in the November before, I had a dream about this talk and that I was feeling a bit resistant to giving it. And in the dream, the organizer of the conference, Karen, comes up to me and says, "Get in the car, you're giving the talk, no excuses." It was quite an interesting dream. So in the dream, I started to submit, and I realized I had to give the talk. And a voice says, "Just start somewhere, the talk will unfold." And as I'm waking from the dream, these phrases came into my head, "The leaven of the wise, the leaven of the wise." And I thought, that's really strange. Well, it turns out that Karen had had a dream, Karen, the organizer of the conference, that involved this leaven of the wise. In her dream, she was given a wafer by a priest with a crop circle design on it, the cross formation with Celtic knot or lover's knot inscribed on it. This pattern in this formation. And when in a later dream Karen asked about this wafer and its meaning, a voice said, "In the dream, it is the leaven of the wise," which in alchemy is a synonym for the goal of the work. It's a synonym for the philosopher's stone. So not only the phrase in my dream links with Karen's dream, but the phrase is from mystic alchemy, and it points to a meaning in the crop circle phenomenon that comes from much deeper down in the historical archetypal unconscious, much deeper down than the patriarchal and rational collective consciousness that prevails today. And so we've talked a little bit about the whys, but I'd like to show you these, just quickly, these these pictures from alchemy. Aren't they amazing? This one is called Celestial Agriculture. Imagine if we approached farming as celestial agriculture. Leaven refers to fermentation. It's a process of the conversion of one substance into another, the yeast that causes the bread to rise, that which makes hops into beer, milk into yogurt, grapes into wine. It occurs naturally. Symbolically, we might say fermentation refers to a kind of effervescence of knowledge, whereby spirit rises above its normal limitations to attain through dreams or intuition knowledge of the deepest secrets of universe, of nature and the universe. And here's a fermentatio, it's called. Aren't these pictures amazing? What do you think they mean? They're so strange, aren't they? Fermentation, again, is connected with transformation, change of consciousness, lead into gold. So, you know, there are many things that I could say about it, and that this isn't actually in my book, but I think I need to get on so we can stop. I was going to give another dream, which I don't have time for, but it had to do with a spiral, with the image of the spiral. And what I came up with in the end about the spiral, and I had actually lots of pictures here, of crop circles where the vivid spirals. Actually, that's not a spiral, that's a circle. It was related to the dream I had. It's a crop circle from Italy. And of course, these are the Northern Lights, which, if you've ever seen them, are absolutely amazing. They come in spiraling designs too. Spiraling galaxies. Spiraling images on bums of goddesses. That's 4000 BC, I think, that one. Newgrange. This was a spiraling something or other that happened over Norway. It was absolutely incredible. You can see it on YouTube. It was called a portal. And it's really extraordinary. You should go online and look at it. It's from December 2009 over Norway. So the mystic spiral connects to the journey of the soul, of course. Jill Peirce's book is absolutely beautiful on that. But after all, I'd gone through my dream that had to do with the spiral crop circle. The theme that touched me most was this idea of the linking of the eternal center with a creative unfolding in time and space. Living as if we're being invited to live with an awareness of the dream time or no time while we inhabit this time. And another dream I had said that the image of for the next phase, for the future, involved this image of the spiral. So I'm still working with that. When we're able to live in the mystery of linear and cyclic time together, perhaps, in which the ego can be in devotion to a larger vision, in touch with the paranormal or magic as a feature of the new story, redeeming and being in service to the world soul, anima mundi, now with the developments of psychology of the depths, together with quantum physics, developments which lead us beyond rational thinking and the discrimination of opposites to a higher illuminative and intuitive imaginal consciousness. Several things can result from this. We're supported to do no harm. or to refrain from criticizing the other, called the projection of the shadow in Jungian psychology, or at least to be aware of it. That we can see the magic of our being here at all. And moreover, at this exciting time of the shifting of the ages, as we move from a restricted view of ourselves and our place on the earth to a much broader vision, we are restored to our station as cosmic citizens with the obligation of witnessing and embodying the compassionate wisdom of the heart and of honoring our human nature as one cell in a larger body of nature. It's all right, I'm going to finish. One more picture from Alchemy. This is a vision of the future human, the Aquarian human from Alchemy. See, that's a real cosmic view, isn't it? The realized human being who is therefore also universal, also cosmic. David White has a poem, What to Remember When Waking. Perhaps we could say, Awakening to the New Myth. It says it well. He says, to be human is to become visible while carrying what is hidden as a gift to others. To remember the other world in this world is to live in your true inheritance. I think this is what we're being called to do, and I think these signatures, as I call them, and a contemplation of these signatures and a delving deeply into their quality and their meaning and the experience of them is... And to a new vast division, as von Franz says, of the whole of life, is what we're about these days. I'm going to stop there. I didn't get to mystical cities and healing sanctuaries, but you can read my book, hopefully. Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.